Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're about to join us for This Week in Law, where our guest this week is Steve Embry. Stefan Spida is here with me, too. We're going to talk about the issuance of the very first fine under the GDPR. We're going to talk about privacy and the insurance industry. Taylor Swift rides to the rescue, and Payless pioneers reverse counterfeiting. All this and more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Stefan Spida, and Matt Curtis. Episode 444, recorded November 30th, 2018. Make it till you fake it. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so excited to have you with us here at the tail end of November, recording November 30th today. We've got a great guest joining us today. Steve Embry is with us. Hi, Steve. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Looking forward to chatting with you, too. Steve is a litigator, a longtime lawyer and a practitioner in the field of things related to technology law. Recent entry into the dark side of the solo practitioner world. So welcome to that, Steve.
Glad to be here.
But longtime experience with a big firm before that, and also joining us from his own big firm, Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle, Washington, is my co-host, Stefan Spida. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, Denise. Hi, Steve. I, for the record, I'd like to say that I'm on the dark side. So I just, solo sounds pretty optimistic to me.
Well. Yeah, I guess that's true. Maybe it's the solo people would say the big firm is the dark side, but it's all good. You gotta learn somewhere, right, Stefan?
Right.
Yes. And of course you practice with the likes of the wonderful Mike Keyes, who was longtime co-host on this show. And most of the folks I've met from your firm are very, very cool. So I think you're probably in a great spot.
Oh yeah, it's great. I really like my colleagues here. Just kidding. It's not the dark side.
Yeah.
Plus I love.
And I should ask, let's ask this at the top of the show before we get into our stories and such. Steve is a longtime blogger at Tech Law Crossroads is his blog,
right.
Where it looks like you blog both about things substantively in the area of technology law. And it also seems as though you're quite fascinated by the intersection of technology and the practice of law. So,
I started the blog because I kept reading about new issues that were coming up, mainly because of technology disruption, and these issues just didn't quite fit into neat pockets of traditional law, traditional precedent. And it really struck me as kind of fascinating how judges, appellate courts were trying to cram these new issues into old buckets, if you will. And It really sort of seemed to me that we really needed to look at these issues anew and perhaps find new solutions without trying to really cram them into old solutions. The example I always use is the litigation over the definition of Uber drivers. Are they employees or are they independent contractors? And at one point in the proceedings, the judge said, you know, maybe we need a new category altogether. Something that's neither an employee or neither an independent contractor. And that's sort of got me thinking, and then that got me into the blogging. And as I continued to blog, I was having so much fun that I decided that's what I would do. I would leave the big firm and go out on my own. I still practice at a kind of a high end advisory place, but the blog's been great. I've had a lot of fun with it, and the only thing I've had trouble with sometimes is focus, because I've interested in a lot of technological things, and so sometimes the blog sort of wanders around a bit, but it's been fun. Thanks.
Well, we're happy to follow your wanderings because if you're interested and passionate about it, then I'm sure that your readers will be too. And Stefan contributes to Dorsey's great The TMCA blog, which is one of my favorite, if not my very favorite, big firm blogs. Because I don't know, you guys have really hit on a way of having entertaining, interesting, scintillating posts and still being part of a big law firm, which I think is pretty unique, Stefan.
Yeah, we're very proud of it, and thanks for acknowledging it. I think we've got a nice mix of contributors, but also the editors, the people sort of control the flow of content, have a great sense of humor and also a good eye for analysis. And I think it comes across on the blog. And we just, again, this year were recognized as one of the top law blogs under the ABAs. I forget exactly what the recognition is, Web 100, I think it's called. It's great to be recognized. And I actually knew about the blog before I joined Dorsey, and it was one of the things that gave me confidence in wanting to come here, because I thought, hey, that's anybody who can put that together and keep it running and keep it insightful like that is thinking about this the right way. So it was fun and exciting to start contributing to it.
Right. So I'm just interested to hear from the two of you. I started out, you know, at the very, very beginning of blogging and don't so much do it anymore. I still have a website where occasionally I'll throw up a post, but I don't really consider it a blog because it's not that. I don't update it very frequently. Instead, I get together with all of you this on a weekly basis here on this show, and I find that sort of fits better into my life. And I don't know. I just like the interaction with you folks rather than sitting behind my computer screen typing away and hitting post. But I'm curious what you two think about the future of blogging. What do you think, Stefan? It seems like it kind of took a big old dip, but now that we're all somewhat skeptical about social media and its role in our lives, do you think blogging will make a comeback?
When I look for recipes online, I often encounter this frustration of getting a recipe that I like, but it's sort of pages and pages of preamble because it's, you know, it has this sort of amateurish quality to it, and everybody's just throwing whatever thoughts they have about, you know, how their uncle really liked the food that they cooked with this recipe. And there's like 15 pictures of an onion being chopped. And then you kind of get to the point at the end. I think we're going to see less of those types of blogs where people are just, you know, whittling away their time, throwing anything they can onto the internet to try to get some sort of a hobby impulse out of their system. But I think what you're going to see maybe is a transformation of things that are sort of traditional media into things that feel more like sophisticated blogs. And I think the line between blog and just regular, you know, internet publication continues to blur. And I think that's good because what you're seeing then is dynamic sort of regularly updated content that's not all that different from a well-established news source, but that has more voices and contributors to it. And I think I got to give a shout out to Serious Eats, which is my favorite source for recipes online. They kind of have that blog format where it feels like a blog, but it's very well curated and it doesn't have that undisciplined sloppiness to it that you so often see on those types of websites. And so I think that to me is a model that makes a lot of sense where, you know, can you really call it a blog at this point? I don't think so, but it has a similar grassroots following to it. And I think you can see similar echoes in other mediums that deal with, not mediums, but subject matters that deal with a similar kind of professionalization without losing that grassroots feel to it. And so I hope that's what keeps happening because those are my favorite types of websites to get information from.
Yeah, I think that's dead on.
I think Stefan is right. I mean, I was kind of hesitant to get into blogging at first because I sort of thought it's all this amateurish kind of mishmash of stuff. And what I discovered is it's to be good at it, it takes a lot of time, and it certainly takes a lot of work. I think the future of blogging is sort of pinpointed. I mean, people who can be well known for a certain niche and who write well and give good insightful articles are going to be around and be successful at it. And I certainly agree with Stefan. I mean, it's there have been various events and things that I've covered with my blog that other people haven't. And the event wouldn't have gotten covered but for the fact that I was there and interested. And, you know, in legal tech circles, you know, it's not, legal technology is not the sexiest topic in the world for people to read. And so a lot of things that happen aren't well covered, but yet they should be for a whole lot of reasons. Not the least of which is we have such a tremendously underserved population out there that we all should be concerned about. So I think the future, I think it's still a future is there. There's always going to be a future for good content, right? I mean, people who write well, who are well prepared, other people will follow and read and come to rely on. And the other opportunity, you know, that I've found about it is it's a great way to exchange ideas with people. You know, there'll be posts and there'll be a discussion about it and comments about it. And we all learn a little bit from those kinds of things. So, for me, it's been a lot of fun. And I hope I can continue with it for some time.
Yeah, we hope you do too. All right, well, let's jump into our rundown here. We were going to start out with some stories that relate to Hollywood music and entertainment. Let's start with Bobby Brown, Stefan. What's going on there?
Bobby Brown is not happy about his portrayal in a new documentary about Whitney Houston. And from what, you know, I was flying a lot in the past couple of weeks, and a lot of people seem to be watching this documentary on airplane. So I think it's getting a lot of viewers, and Bobby Brown's not happy about it. And I believe he's asserting his rights of publicity to try to put a stop to it. And I'm not familiar with all the nuances and the facts, but what I find interesting about it is it's hard for me to know where to draw the line when someone does bad things. And very publicly and does those bad things to somebody who is also famous, should the person be able to control the distribution of that information that about what they've done by asserting these types of causes of action? It seems to chill the flow of information that is highly salient and interesting, and there's obviously a market for it. And so I don't know that much about the underlying...
I found this... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Yeah, I found it somewhat ironic that you have a person, Bobby Brown, whose main claim to fame with a lot of people is the fact that he was married to Whitney Houston, and now there's a documentary about Whitney Houston, and he owes his publicity to the fact he was married to her, and he's now saying, well, you know, you appropriated my public name for your show, a public name I wouldn't have had but for you anyway. It just strikes me as kind of ironic. I wonder, you know, the show is certain. Well, it's a documentary. It's newsworthy. The Bobby Brown piece of it. I mean, I've not seen it, but knowing the story, it's a pretty important part of the story, and which, you know, it strikes me that he may have a bit of an uphill battle by virtue of that fact. But I suppose we will see.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it takes too much to establish that you have a name, image, and likeness that's protectable. It does vary state by state, which I was just looking up where this lawsuit was filed, and I'm not finding it real quickly. I'm guessing it was filed in California. Do you know, Stefan?
I don't, actually. I was just trying to figure that out.
Other article. No, not off the top of my head. But, you know, not every state has a right of publicity law. There's no national one. They do differ. And I think some of them would tend to support what you were just saying, Steve, that in order for you to prevail, you have to have some sort of palpable, measurable public figure kind of status, almost like a defamation claim, the way that comes in there sometimes. Right. In other states like California, Your name, image, and likeness just have to be used for commercial purposes without your consent. And
it is certainly a fair debate. I mean, I would think that the Whitney Houston documentary people are going to say, well, you know, yes, it's a documentary, But it's a news story, essentially. We're telling a news story, and we have a First Amendment freedom of press right, freedom of speech right, to tell that story. And Bobby Brown is a public figure, and what he did and his relationship with Whitney is part and parcel of that news story. So I think the battleground in the case is going to be what you just said. I mean, it's right at the intersection between your right to own your own publicity, if you will, and the freedom of press rights that news agencies, bloggers, if you will, have to tell a news story. And the fact that it's a documentary on screen, you know, wouldn't matter whether it was on a screen or in a newspaper, for that matter. I mean, where do you draw that line between right of publicity and freedom of press?
Yeah, that's going to be a tough issue in this case. Folks in IRC are quick to point out that Bobby Brown is an R&B singer in his own right. He's saying it's my prerogative, which was a pretty big hit. So I guess we could, you know, argue about whether that was all piggybacking off of his relationship with Whitney. But then I think we'd be more like TMZ than This Week in Law. So, rapidly going down that rabbit hole.
Probably shows my musical taste and age that I was much more familiar with Whitney Houston than Bobby Brown as an entertainer.
But yeah, I think it is going to be super interesting. The other thing that occurred to me as I was reading through, it's a $2 million lawsuit filed on behalf of Bobby Brown and the couple's daughter, whose name, image, and likeness were also in the film. The other thing that occurred to me is whether fair use would come into play here. But again, I think, you know, because there was a lot of you'd have to get into who took the footage, et cetera, who owns the copyright of the footage to even have that fair use discussion. And I'm not quite sure. They haven't brought it up in the lawsuit, as far as I can tell. It's a right of publicity and Lanham Act claim about the trademarks involved as well. So interesting stuff. We'll have to see what the court does with it. And we'll keep you posted as we see more news about it. Something else we should keep you posted about that we talked about right around Halloween, of course, was the Satanic Temple suing Netflix and who was the studio? I think it's Warner. Yeah, Warner Brothers, over its Baphomet statue being featured so prominently in Netflix's Sabrina, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. They have already settled. The Satanic Temple seems happy with the settlement, although most of it is confidential, so we're not really going to know the terms unless all of a sudden the statue of Baphomet is no longer in the show, front and center in the shots of the school, which is what the Satanic Temple was so concerned about. The school itself, I haven't watched much of the show. I actually started to try and watch it, but haven't really gotten hooked on it yet. But apparently the school is all about evil, cannibalism, and murder, according to the Satanic Temple. And they don't want to be associated with that. So they apparently have reached some sort of understanding about the use of their symbol. And they're going to get attribution in the credits of the shows that have already aired using the symbol itself, which apparently is enough to make them happy. Stefan, any thoughts about this?
Yeah, the two things come to mind. One, I see that part of the settlement is acknowledgement of the Satanic Temple's ownership of the unique elements of the statue. And so I think it's going to be pretty funny because now the show is effectively proselytizing on behalf of the Satanic Temple for anybody watching it. You know, it'll be not unlike staying at a Marriott and finding a copy of the Book of Mormon on your desk. You know, this will be watching Sabrina and finding, inspiring invitation to join the Satanic Temple, which I just think is hilarious. I'll spare my second point. I was going to go down a rabbit hole about how, you know, Satan is just an angel who didn't get the promotion he wanted. So in a sense, he's kind of like a solo practitioner, perhaps. But I'll spare that sort of loop back to our discussion about who's on the dark side.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, one person who's not on the dark side as far as other creators go at all is Taylor Swift, who was renegotiating or negotiating a record deal, deciding who her label was going to be. And she opted to go with Universal Music Group, although she was talking to a number of them. She said the key deal point for her was the fact that Universal Music Group agreed, and Republic Records, I guess, is part of them, agreed that they, now the details of this have not quite been worked out or made public at any rate, but the company and all the record labels at this point own shares in Spotify. And she cut a deal where artists will share in the proceeds from the ownership of those shares. So it just seems like a great way for Taylor Swift to use her influence to help others also profit off the streaming industry in the way that their record labels already are. You probably remember that Taylor Swift went to bat for artists when Apple Music was not compensating them for streams during its trial period for new users when it first launched. And I assume it's still doing that trial period, even though it's been several years now that it's been available. So, Stefan, any thoughts about this?
Well, at the outset of the show, before we were live, you mentioned you didn't have any tie-ins to Bolshevism, and I think this just undercuts that.
I think you're right. Taylor, we found it.
Comrade Swift has stood up for workers' rights, and I'm glad she has, because I think it's, you know, if you look at any of the data about revenues made by artists, there's sort of this concentration at the top, and then it's kind of dries up pretty quickly after that. And I think for someone with her market power to use that power ostensibly for good, to help distribute royalties more fairly, I think will be great. I don't know the details of the arrangement. I don't know. She doesn't seem to me like the kind of person who acts with uninterested benevolence. She might have some angle here. I don't know what that angle would be. It's pretty deep in the weeds of licensing and the sort of pretty obscure details about how royalties are paid out. But I think on its face, it seems like a really good move, and it's a sort of a surprising move, and maybe it's in line with a more sort of politicized Taylor Swift that we've seen in the last few months. And to the extent it helps artists get their money back for some of this work that they've done and put out there, I think it's great, and I'm glad to see her do it.
At the end of this Rolling Stone piece that we have in our discussion points, you can read all the things that we've read to get ready for the show. If you go to tagpacker.com/user/ This Week in Law, we're on episode 444 this week. They mentioned that Universal Music owns, at today's valuation, about $1 billion worth of Spotify stock. So we are not talking about small chunks of change here. Steve, what were you going to say?
Well, it's a couple of things. One, I think it's the equity value of those Spotify shares. You could certainly argue that comes from the artists whose music people are listening to. I mean, most people get Spotify, obviously, to listen to music. And the fact that you have artists on there, you know, increases the value. I wonder, though, what the enforceability of the arrangement will be for non-parties to the contract, other artists. It's well, nice and good to say, okay, everybody's going to get a piece of the pie, but this is essentially a deal between Taylor Swift and Universal. And so when somebody else comes along and wants to enforce it, query, you know, will they be able to? It sort of strikes me as your kind of classic third-party beneficiary contract. And, you know, I haven't looked at those things much since law school, but I remember that it wasn't – they weren't slam dunks. So, you know, maybe the kind of thing that didn't cost Universal much to do, looks good, everybody's happy. At the end of the day, you know, how will it work out? But I think it's great that she stood up and for the artist she has before, and they're certainly entitled to. You know, the artists for years have been taken advantage of, mainly by record companies, and, you know, most of their claim to fame and their ability to make money now hinges on the big tours and promotion and concerts, less than the actual records and music itself. So any help that they can get, particularly from those who are able to reap benefits at the top, so much the better. There's a lot of starving artists out there, I know.
Yeah, and definitely. I hope this doesn't just sort of go away with the news cycle, and that artists do remember that, hey, we're supposed to be getting a cut of that, and they hold their feet to the fire on that and follow up and make sure it happens. And again, it seems like this is either not completely detailed and worked out, or they're just not making those details public yet. But
don't know. And as I understand it, you only get the cut as an artist if they sell the stock at some point. So again, you know, if Universal holds the stock, then they get to make the call when it's sold, and so they hold a lot of cards still in the arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, any final thoughts on that?
I think those are good points. I mean, this is obviously a very complex arrangement, and who knows how it shakes out. Maybe it's just good marketing, but it's also kind of niche marketing. So I'm going to give her credit for doing something that, you know, most of her fans aren't going to understand. So it's not like it's a total goodwill gesture that's going to translate to everybody and make her look good. I mean, it seems to have some meat to it. It's just a question of whether it's going to bear out. So I hope they get paid.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Probably be more important to the artist than it will be to the public in general, which, you know, is good because they need some help.
So here's something to pay attention to that it appears the music industry, the film industry are paying attention to. You remember SOPA and PIPA and how everyone got upset about those proposed laws and they didn't get passed?
Internet Freedom Day.
Yes, Internet Freedom Day, and still, you know, there's a lot of attention, I think, on that issue. But it's been several years. It's been since 2012 that those laws officially were shelved and taken off the table. But don't get complacent, because they've been shelved and taken off the table in the U.S., but not necessarily in other countries. I know Australia, for one, has a site blocking law that is in effect now, and other jurisdictions as well have been playing around with the concept, even though here in the United States we got quite upset about it and vocal about it. And the music industry and the film industry are not ignoring the fact that other folks have been sort of sandboxing this and seeing if it works for them. And over at Torrent Freak, Ernesto has a great post about some comments that have been submitted to this sounds like a federal agency or individual federal employee, the Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator, whose name is Vishal Amin. And Vishal requested input from the public on the new version of his office's Joint Strategic Plan for Intellectual Property Enforcement. So as part of their public comments, the Copyright Alliance has submitted its thoughts, and the RIAA and the National Music Publishers Association have submitted theirs. And all of them have raised the very sort of obliquely, but have yet directly referenced this whole notion of site blocking under SOPA, you know, as would have been implemented under SOPA or PIPA. And their take seems to be, hey, you know, we shouldn't ignore what other countries are doing. They're experimenting with this. They're finding ways to do it that alleviate all the fears that people had about these laws. And maybe, you know, we shouldn't lose sight of that, and we should be keeping an eye on that. So if you are one of those folks who were upset about the notion of site blocking being a thing here in the United States, definitely pay attention to this issue and the fact that as far as the music and film industry are concerned, it's not necessarily dead here in the United States. Stefan, what do you think of this?
I love the selective look to, you know, international law whenever it sort of suits an industry group. I mean, if we're going to look to other countries for their examples, maybe we should look at healthcare, education, gun control. Let's not jump in finding new felonies that, you know, I based on accidental streaming of copyrighted content. So I love the sort of the marketing aspect of, well, we're not being unreasonable. We're just looking to see what other countries are doing here. And it turns out it's working out for them. Yeah. Well, if you apply that concept, then maybe we can find more pressing issues to address by the same reasoning. I mean, the one thing America doesn't have too few of is felonies. And finding a felony, as this post suggests, streaming would end up being in something like this just seems silly to me. I hope people respond accordingly.
Right. The music groups actually want to, quote unquote, fix the DMCA, as they say, making it a felony to knowingly engaged in unauthorized streaming of copyrighted works. Love to know how they're going to find out if somebody's knowingly engaging in unauthorized streaming. Raised a great point.
I was thinking, Denise, when you said, well, their argument is that the site blocking has worked so well in other countries, why don't we do it here? And I immediately thought, well, yeah, it's worked out really well in China. They're very effective at site blocking. I don't think that's quite what we want. Yeah, they think it's fine. But yes. And that's the problem with something like that, is it's the proverbial slippery slope. You know, it's one of those things that sounds really good, you know, when you cast it in terms of let's protect copyright, intellectual property and starving artists and all that stuff. But what we're really talking about is the ability of very large companies, very profitable companies who control the industry to be able to block access. And there are lots of arguments in and around it from all sides. But the thing that would worry me about it is the fact that it's, you know, this time it's websites with that are selling music or movies. And next time maybe it'll be something else. And we walk down that road and it's hard to walk back from.
Yes. So don't lose sight of your vigilance and opinions on the issue if you had them back in 2010 and 2012. They may be needed yet again. Before we move on to our final entertainment-related story, let's put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We put these phrases in case you are watching or listening to the show in hope of receiving professional credit in your field, perhaps the legal field, perhaps another one. So sometimes you need to show to your oversight body, compliance body, that you actually watched or listened. We put these phrases in for that reason. Our first one is going to be benevolent tailor. We'll put another one in before the end of the show. If you need more information and you are a lawyer in the United States, head on over to twit.to/MCLE. We've got some more info there for you that may be of assistance. Finally, before we leave the realm of Hollywood and entertainment, including the video gaming arena, a story caught my eye about an 8-year-old kid who created a Fortnite skin that he named the Tender Defender. It was from a drawing that he did. His dad posted said drawing. It's a chicken character. And the dad posted it on Reddit along with the 8-year-old whose name is Connor's note, who said, "Dear Fortnite, please add a skin in Fortnite called the Chicken Trooper." Well, renamed it the Tender Defender. Lo and behold, Fortnite has boldly gone into the chicken skin business and offered the Tender Defender, which I've never actually played the game myself, but if I could play as the Tender Defender, it might just suck me in. It's available in the game's item store, and Connor's family have been compensated by Epic Games. So my initial question about...
I like the dad's comment. The dad's, after all had happened, the eight-year-old's dad's comment was, you made me the coolest dad alive.
He may be. He may be. I love making a kid's dream come true in that way. And I love the fact that we don't have to sit here and wonder whether it was an implied license when they posted it to Reddit and that Epic could just go ahead and pluck it into the game and not compensate the family. They apparently did, although I don't know the details of that. Stefan, any thoughts?
Well, I can just imagine this eight-year-old sort of forcing this anecdote into conversations at eight-year-old cocktail parties and his friends all rolling their eyes about, oh, here we go again, the story about the I don't know anything about this kid. I'm sure he's a perfectly nice, nice child, but he's going to take that one to the, you know, he's going to spin that yarn for a while, I'm sure, and his friends are all going to get sick of it. So,
So when he gets out of college, he's going to, the first thing on his resume is going to be,
I made the chicken defender. Yes. Oh, sorry. Now I have a thing on that I forgot to turn off before the show. Sorry, turning off volume right now. There it goes. Hey, so many things to turn off before the show. All right, let's move on to talk about some privacy related stories. Where to start? Let's start, because actually this kind of reminds me of artists hopefully making sure that they get a cut of whatever deal Taylor Swift cut with Universal, making sure that you're looking out for your own interests. There is a guy named Tony Schmidt who has sleep apnea, who definitely... is good at looking after his own interests. He has a CPAP machine, and he figured out after his first night of usage of the machine, he got a message, I believe it was an email, from the device manufacturer praising him on, you know, how great he slept and how well he used his machine and that he'd earned some kind of badge. And he began to realize that the machine was phoning home, not just to his doctor, but to his health insurer, to the device manufacturer itself. He was not real happy about this. So he filed complaints with the Better Business Bureau and the federal government. There's really nothing happening with those complaints, but at least he's made the issue public. And people who use CPAP machines know that this is a problem. And I think it's a greater problem, not just for this particular medical device, but for medical devices going forward. This, like many of them, is an expensive thing that a health insurance carrier might cover, that a patient might need the health insurance carrier to cover if they're going to use it. And in this particular instance, this machine, you know, if your sleep apnea is bad enough, this thing can save your life. But if you can't afford to have it, then you might need your carrier to cover it. And if the carrier is going to cover it, they might demand that it give the carrier all kinds of information about the way you're using the machine, your various health details that it can glean as you use it, et cetera, et cetera. So not a real super positive story here, because, I mean, it's good that we're having the conversation, but I really don't see this problem going away. And I do see more and more people saying, hey, well, you know, I need the machine. So I guess not only my doctor gets this information, but so do all these other third parties too. What do you think about this, Steve?
Well, it's a big issue. You know, it's we now have the capacity to generate all this data from all these places. And we also have the capacity not just to collect it, but to monitor it and to analyze it and to use artificial intelligence programs to figure out what to do with it. And the insurance industry is is going to be right at the heart of this. You know, and it's not just medical devices. There was an article not too long ago about an electric toothbrush, which would basically collect data from how many times you brushed your teeth. And it's not hard to very far-fetched to say, okay, well, what if your health insurance carrier, dental carrier, were to say, all right, Denise, we're looking at the records here, and you didn't brush your teeth every day last week, and so we're going to increase your premium by some amount. And you know, this is already being contemplated by insurance carriers in the automobile industry. And I wrote a post about this not too long ago. But the notion is that data from your automobile can be collected and transmitted, and insurance carriers, your automobile carrier, can look at the data and make real-time premium decisions based on what it finds, how fast you go, what part of town you're going to, all those kinds of things. And you know, it kind of demonstrates where we are with privacy in a lot of ways, because we all give up privacy every day, all over the place. And this is just another example. I mean, the man with the sleep apnea machine, he could decline to use the machine because he does not want that data transmitted. So what's his option? Get another machine that sends it to somebody else. What if your insurance carrier came to you and said, you can get a 10% discount on your insurance premium, provided that you let us collect and monitor your data? Most people, I think, would say, well, that's fine. Sure. Yeah. Take 10% off. I'm a good driver. And so do we really want that kind of intrusion into our lives? Do we really want our carriers, insurance carriers, looking at those things constantly and making those kinds of decisions about our insurance? It's a real thorny problem, and it's compounded by the fact that we often don't think about ownership of data in a very realistic way. You know, we have, anytime you get an app or new software, you have this very lengthy consent form that most of us don't read and we just agree to. Well, the reason they have those forms is so you can give away your data, right? I mean, it's at core, it's your data, but we often just give it away for nothing, for the convenience of using whatever device that we want to use. And, you know, at some point you have to say, well, what's the concept of privacy mean, where we've all just basically given it away without thinking. And this is a prime example of that. I mean, I think we're going to see more and more uses of the data by insurance carriers to make decisions about premiums, to make decisions about insurability, to make all sorts of decisions that will affect us in a very real way. Do we want that as a society? I don't know. It's a tough question.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's something that regulators are going to have to start paying attention to and looking at, as far as balancing those concerns of privacy and the interests of the insurance industry. What do you think, Stefan?
I find it pretty disturbing how many of these issues boil down to the logic of, if you've done nothing wrong, you have nothing to hide. It's a very insidious way to think about life in general. And I think most people, given a very modest incentive financially, for example, will do things that have downstream effects that are pretty dystopian. And they can always rationalize it by saying, well, I'm behaving properly, and in exchange, I'm getting a little bit of a financial benefit. So this is a rational thing for me to do. And it's outside the scope of my concern to deliberate about the cumulative effect of all these decisions and how they might impact people who aren't me. And I think that is the default mode that people operate in. I believe that they just sort of look out for themselves and they respond to very basic incentives. It's hard to convince people to think beyond that. And I don't even know that we've begun the conversation of how we might do that. So I really do see, you know, the status quo right now being some kind of a dystopian future where we're all constantly being surveyed and our technology sort of moves from being this thing that we use as a convenience to something that kind of controls us. And the only way to avoid that would be to have a truly insightful regulatory framework that accounts for people's inability to think beyond themselves. And I just don't see any kind of movement in that direction. I mean, you've got people who in academic circles or in sort of nonprofit circles are making the arguments, but to then take those arguments and scale them up to where they compete with the kind of reasoning that I laid out at the outset, you know, the if you're not doing anything wrong, then you've got nothing to hide. You kind of need a similar aphorism to help people say, you know, in that same intuitive way, combat this idea, because otherwise, 10 years from now, I think many of our kind of routines will be very closely monitored and will impact sort of ranking in society, so to speak, and will kind of impact our credit scores, our insurance premiums, our ability to get employed. And a lot of that will be dictated algorithmically. And yeah, it's up to us to stop it if we don't want it. And I just don't see any kind of signs that we're doing that right now.
Yeah, I was thinking as you were talking about David Eggers' book, The Circle Game, which was turned into a movie, which I thought, by the way, was a horrible movie. But I thought the book was actually pretty good. But you know, when you read the book, you sort of start off and say, well, that makes sense. Yeah, I can say that makes sense. And then you go down this road till you say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. And I think that's kind of the argument here. I did an interview not too long ago with a woman who's general counsel for a company that is trying to create a recognition among people that their health data, first of all, they own their health data. It's their data. And two, it's worth something. It has a value. And it particularly has a value to Big Pharma because while Big Pharma gets a lot of data, it's not very robust because they don't have, they're not supposed to have the kind of identifiable, personally identifiable information that would make it more pertinent. So they're trying to create via the blockchain an ability for people to better control that data and make decisions about it, whether they want to sell it to pharmaceutical companies, whether they want to keep it, what they want to do. And so, you know, that I think is a noble effort. Like Stefan, I'm not sure how far that's going to go because we seem to so willy-nilly just give everything away and don't even think that it's our data a lot of times. As I was reading through the notes for this show, I was thinking about it and it sort of hit me that, you know, I own this stuff. You know, it's my stuff. The fact that I give it away doesn't mean I didn't own it at one time. It is my stuff. And people, you know, sort of forget that. And, you know, query whether the courts are going to recognize the value of kind of privacy and data in the judicial arena, whether government's going to get involved. It's a sticky wicket all the way around. But I think Stefan is exactly right. Unless there's a better recognition of privacy and maybe a new view of what privacy really means in today's society, we're headed to a point where, you know, as many people say, we already are. Privacy is dead, meaningless. It's a meaningless concept, and I don't think that's what we want. I mean, there are things that I think we would all agree need to be kept forever private. And we may not be able to stop them from becoming public.
Yeah, and I would just encourage folks to take the example from Tony Schmidt, this CPAP user here, to, you know, if you see something weird going on or data going somewhere where it shouldn't, not to roll over on that, but to make a stink about it. My own healthcare insurer asked us, as it's processing a claim for some treatment my son had, it asked for a copy of the detailed doctor's report in assessing whether or not the claim would be covered. And it already had all the codes that it needed, you know, all those things that say what treatments were given, et cetera. So I really felt like it had what it needed. I went ahead and sent them the report they asked for, but I wrapped it in all kinds of, and not everyone can do this, but I just, you know, whatever you can do to make them think about it, I think is important. I wrapped it in all kinds of legalese about what they could do with the report when they had it, who could see it, that it had to be destroyed after review, that it couldn't be stored, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that completely brought the claim to a dead halt because I haven't heard from them since. I think that their legal department is still scratching their head about, well, gee, can we use this report or not? But, you know, I think that it pays to send a message to the folks that are asking for your data, as Steve points out, who might not be entitled to it if you don't give it to them, that data and its privacy matters to you, and to emphasize that as much as you can.
Here's sort of the flip side of that too. I mean, it's as you were talking about the healthcare issue. I don't know if you've ever been in a position where you have to get your health records that are in one hospital chain to a doctor in a hospital that are in another hospital system, but it's a royal pain in the you know what. As you're going through it, you think, you can't just access them and look at them so the doctor can give me the correct care. I've got to fill out a form, send the form, file it with the appropriate regulators, wait, 2 weeks. That's assuming that they're going to comply with the regulations, and they're not. So it's another 2 weeks. Then you literally have to go over to the office and, stand there till they hand them to you. So you've got all this inconvenience that you have to suffer from somewhat because of bureaucracy, but somewhat because of the recognition of the privacy associated with health records. So when you start hitting people with that, their reaction is, well, no, just give it to them so I can get on with my life, right?
Right.
So that's the dilemma that we have with a lot of these privacy issues, and it's what Stefan was referring to, is you frequently make these decisions based on convenience, and you don't ever think, well, that's going to have some repercussions down the road. Do I really want them? And the article that Ellie Mistal wrote about Skylink brings that out. I mean, he has elected, and he's one of the editors at Above the Law, who's, I think we can all safely agree, is fairly outspoken. But he's elected not to use Alexa. Because he fears the collection of data, maybe fear is the wrong word. He's concerned about it and doesn't want that intrusion in his life. And that's great. I mean, he has made the informed decision to do that. I've made the informed decision to have one. It's sitting here looking at me right now, probably listening to every word that I've said. But I made that election for convenience. So that's great for people like me, for people like Ellie, for people like Denise and Stefan. But there's so many people out there that I think they don't go through that thought process. They just say, I want that new gadget. I'm getting it. And I don't care what happens to my stuff. I don't care if Amazon now listens to what I am doing and is going to give me ads about all sorts of stuff that I may have commented on not very long ago. So that's the kind of the part that is a little bit of a disconnect, is it's the informed consent piece. I don't think as a legal system we've really focused a whole lot on that. What does that mean in the context of the new technology and the digital age? What do we have to say? What do we have to show to say that we have given the customer or the purchaser the opportunity to make an informed decision about their data privacy rights?
Yeah, Londog in IRC has a great comment that harkens back to your reference, Steve, of the circle, where little decisions along the way seem to make sense at the time, but then you put them all together and maybe you've agreed to something that you had no idea the scope of. His comment is, I might as an insurance company be able to look at all the food you buy and what type of foods you buy to determine your insurance rate risk. I can see from your food purchases that you don't buy much healthy food. I see this being an issue at some point in the future. And of course, when you get one of those loyalty cards from a supermarket, you're usually given some sort of little folder that it comes in. I'm sure nobody reads those. I'm sure that many grocery store chains probably preserve to themselves the right to sell that data. to people like your insurance carrier, and then nobody thinks that through, and you know, hence why data privacy regulation is so much on our minds and on lawmakers' minds. I guess that is maybe a good segue. Before I segue, though, I should get Stefan to chime in on any of this before we move on. I was about to start talking about the GDPR. Stefan, anything you want to mention on these sort of bigger picture data connection issues before we dive into the first GDPR fine that has been imposed?
I don't want to just be too repetitive. I think I echo a lot of what everybody said. I think it would be very interesting for somebody to write an article or a book or something that lays out sort of the path from where we are today to like a 10-year plan, again, referencing the Bolsheviks, a 10-year plan that lays out how we can get to a point in the future where we have all the benefits of technology that we like and the minimal number of sort of unintended consequences or really negative totalitarian kind of effects of that technology. And it's sort of amazing to me that we rarely discuss it in those terms, because it's almost like we're passive recipients of the benefits of the technology and we're so in awe of it when it comes that we don't kind of have any way of discussing it other than just sort of this pearl clutching moralizing, as opposed to how can we talk about this in a way that is constructive, and how can we say, great, we want this benefit, we accept it, and as a society, we're going to come up with a path on containing that so that we're not just passive in the face of the changes that are happening. Often you have this sort of neo-Luddite movement where people just sort of reject it for a while and then eventually they start using it. Or you have this sort of geeky early adopter thing where they don't think about it at all and they're just going to go head first. Why isn't there sort of a more pragmatic approach that someone has laid out that says, we're as a society going to collectively discuss how to absorb the benefits and minimize the costs, and we're going to come up with frameworks for dealing with that. It just seems like that's within our grasp. It's totally imaginable. It's just standard regulatory thinking, but it doesn't, for some reason, it doesn't kind of have a lot of traction as a way of thinking about the problem, and I would love to see more of it.
I don't know. I mean, it strikes me, you could say the same thing about the music industry and why aren't artists getting fairly compensated, that we have a way to think about that regulatorily that would make sense. But the competing interests in the industry don't seem to want to come to a sensible solution. And I think it may be true with this data issue as well.
The GDPR, it was certainly appears to be an effort to do something like what Stefan is describing. I mean, you know, you can argue whether it's successful or not, but you know, I heard a talk the other day that sort of focused on the differences in outlook between the Europeans about such things as privacy and we as Americans. And it's based in part upon the history of what happened in Europe during and before World War II, where the society experienced kind of firsthand a totalitarian regime and what it could do. And in those days, we were talking about analog data, but we were talking about data essentially, and what could be done with them and the abuses that could be. And having had that experience, at least so the theory goes, they were much more interested in and sensitive to the rights of privacy, which is what the GDPR is trying to do, and which I think California is trying to do and has done with their new statute, and to some extent Illinois has done with their biometric statute as well. So, you know, there is some recognition out there about doing something, and I think it's kind of coming to a head more and more with the Facebook scandals and issues that are going on and some others. So maybe we are kind of reaching a point where people are saying enough is enough. We're going to take some steps to try to reel this in a little bit.
All right. I would be remiss if I let us move away from the discussion of the phoning home CPAP machine without mentioning that a few years ago we were talking about a phoning home marital aid as well. So these things are not going away. They're proliferating into various and sundry areas. All right. Speaking of the GDPR, its very first fine has been levied by a German privacy regulator against the maker of a chat app called, I think it's called Noodles, K-N-U-D-D-E-L-S, which had a security breach. And it was, however, very upfront and very transparent about its security breach. They have had over 1.8 million passwords stolen. 330,000 of those have been confirmed. 800,000 email addresses also. So, they're still like in the middle of dealing with the problem, but they've come forward with it. And for that reason, they were not fined that much money. 20,000 euros is the amount of the first ever GDPR fine issued, which comes to $22,700. Upshot of this seems to be, you know, that the privacy regulators in the EU really want companies to be coming forward with this information and trying to fix it. And if so, they're going to be treated more gently under the law. Do you think that's the right outcome, Stefan?
So I'll have to confess that the GDPR, the details of the GDPR are something that I've studiously avoided learning because everyone was complaining about it when they were trying to get compliance in order, it became sort of a game to me to see how little I could learn just to kind of irritate the people who were. And I say that somewhat facetiously, but at a certain point it was all anybody could talk about. And I was like sticking my head in the sand, not to learn it. So I don't quite have an opinion on whether this is the right outcome, strictly speaking, under the law. So I don't want to say the wrong thing here and just sort of, you know, completely blow any credibility I could possibly have on the topic. What I will say is that it's interesting that it seems to be sort of a measured approach. I think one of the concerns about the GDPR was that it was going to be like a nuclear bomb going off and like destroying all innovation. Whereas this seems like it, maybe they're showing some restraint. And so I don't know how that maps to what's in the law, but the company was upfront. Maybe they were concerned about the threat of being nuked if they didn't comply, and the regulatory body seems to have been quite modest in its assessment of the fine. And so it's just a kind of first principles. Is this how a law like this should be working? It seems right to me. Now, have I read the details and gone deep on it? No. And I will continue to avoid doing that now.
That was how the GDPR was described when it was being enacted by the European regulators, that they were not going to go out and play games of gotcha with companies, that they really wanted to use this as a tool to combat data breach problems, cybersecurity problems, which are proliferating at a ungodly pace. There's a cultural difference at play here too. You know, in the United States, the typical reaction to something like this, and I've had clients that have been involved in this, the typical reaction to this is, we're going to fight it. The regulators are overstepping their bounds, so we have to fight back. I always like to counsel that, particularly in the data breach area, you don't have a lot of leeway here. You need to be a little more transparent, a little more cooperative with the regulators if you want to accomplish anything. But so there's a bit of a culture issue, and I wonder sometimes whether the reverse of that in this country is the regulators, because they know they're going to get so much pushback from the regulated entities that they do push a little harder and go a little further than they would otherwise, because everybody's then negotiating toward the middle. I don't know that for a fact, but it wouldn't surprise me. That's kind of how the world works. But in terms of an approach, this would seem to be the correct approach. What I think you would want to get to in the data breach cybersecurity area is a partnership between all concerned, all relevant entities to combat what is a pretty pervasive and ongoing threat that probably can't be combated without a more robust partnership with industry and government. So that's something you'd want to encourage, I would think.
Well, we were talking before the show about the Marriott breach, which just became public yesterday. The fact, Steve, that you think your data may be subject to that breach just because of your use of the Marriott system. So the other thing that you had sent over were some stories about other data breaches and your own personal thought that there doesn't seem to be a lot of litigation in the U.S. over these breaches.
It's an interesting fact. I mean, the most recent studies show that about 51% of companies in America have suffered a data breach. And that's a huge, and it's a pretty staggering statistic. That's more than half of corporate America. Now, that's not to say they've all been damaged by it, by the breaches, or anything has been done with the information that was taken. But that's a pretty staggering statistic. And so, you know, you then wonder, okay, is this going to be the next wave of litigation for the future? So far, it hasn't been. You know, very few of these data breaches result in civil litigation. And when I say civil litigation, I mainly mean consumers bringing class actions against, say, the Marriott. Credit card issues between banks, issuing banks, and merchants are different because there's, you know, there is money at stake, but there are a tremendous number of hurdles that plaintiffs would have to go through to win one of these cases for data breach or cybersecurity flaws. You know, standing, whether there's been damage, whether there's an appropriate class action. And, you know, even winning the case, if you had to try one of these cases in front of a jury, I mean, where you have 51% of the corporations in the world suffering data breaches, is the likely reaction going to be these are just inevitable. And I think as time goes on, I mean, you know, as we were talking before the show, some of my information have been stolen. Well, probably not the first time, and it's probably not the last. And am I terribly worried about it? No, I'm not terribly worried about it.
Right.
Maybe I should be. But so if I were on a jury and somebody came in and said I've been horribly damaged by a data breach, I'd say, well, I had four or five of them. I get one of those letters every month. I don't seem to be suffering a whole lot. So I think that's part of the reason we have not seen as much litigation as you would have thought. That's not to say the big ones have not been subject to that kind of litigation, the Equifax and probably Marriott. But when you've got all these other smaller ones going on that don't result in litigation, that's something is going on that's chilling that kind of litigation. And that's also not to say that the regulatory aspects of data breach and the FTC and enforcement actions have been moving full steam ahead. So to the extent there is ongoing kind of adversarial proceedings, that seems to be where most of it falls, particularly for small to mid-sized businesses. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon. Four or five years ago, I would have, if I were predicting as a lawyer where the next big thing would be, I would have said it's going to be data breach litigation because it's going to happen all over the place. Well, it's happening all over the place. A lot of people aren't suing.
Yeah, you know, I have a couple of thoughts to close out this topic. Number one, I wonder if, you know, for all of the breach and, you know, privacy protection law, data protection laws, et cetera, that regulators want to enact, I wonder if maybe a more practical solution might be where this is headed. I don't remember where I read this, but in the last couple of weeks, I remember stumbling across a story that referenced someone trying to come up with a new kind of credit card that has a constantly changing number. It's basically like the LastPass idea for passwords, where all you would have to remember as the consumer is one key, and then something dynamic would be generated each and every time you used your card. So that if you're, you know, one of those dynamic instances were compromised in something like the Marriott breach that was made public yesterday, over 500 million guests impacted by that, by the way. So if one dynamic instance of what your credit card was at one time were compromised, that would be useless to anybody to share or try and sell, et cetera, because it's only the current instance that actually works. I like this idea. I don't know where I saw it, but I appreciate that someone's working on it. And it made me think, you know, I wind up as much as possible using something like PayPal, which has my credit card information in it, but doesn't, you know, when I use it, I'm not required to then share that, unfortunately, non-dynamic number with yet another third party. Because, you know, it would take PayPal being compromised if you could only, you know, use that. So I wonder if those kinds of practical solutions might be where we're headed as the remedy to the fact that people seem to leak data like sieves. And then the other, well, you know, I mean, regardless of the laws or the litigation. Yeah.
In Europe, they actually require you to input a PIN when you use your credit card, mm-hmm. personal PIN, sort of like you do when you use a debit card at an ATM machine. So that was not imposed here, mainly because the banks thought it would be sort of a revolt by consumers, that would be too much trouble. Query whether it's too much trouble to input a PIN each time you go to Walmart versus having to get a new credit card sent to you because your old one has been stolen. I think I'd rather put the PIN in, but you know, that's just me. But yeah, I have heard about the same thing that you were talking about, Denise, mm-hmm. and it's certainly an option that I hope would be developed, because it's happening with more and more frequency, and it's not so bad when they take your financial numbers, because you know your credit card, your bank's gonna take care of it, and it's, you know, just an inconvenience. But when they start getting your identity and you start getting letters in the mail about debts that you owe that you never heard of, then it becomes, you know, then it's crossed from being a pain in the butt to a real problem.
Right. Then the other comment we got from IRC is, again, from Londog, who was wondering about data breach insurance policies. And you just attended a conference where you had some thoughts about those. Yes, they exist, but you noticed another weird sort of insurance industry privacy conundrum there. Can you tell us about that, Steve?
Well, it's what I referred to before, and that is the mm-hmm. collection of data to real time make adjustments in premium or insurance decisions. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are cyber policies. It's become a huge market. When I first attended that conference, 5 years ago, I remember sitting at a table with a bunch of young underwriters who were just gushing over these new cyber insurance policies that they were writing and selling right and left, and they were really enthusiastic. And I said, "Oh," looked up and said, "Well, what about the claims?" And you would have thought that I had just you know. Done something inappropriate at the table. They looked at me like, claims? Well, this year's conference was all about claims and what the insurance industry is going to do with claims that are being made under these cyber policies. The cyber policies themselves, you know, when you get a automobile policy or a commercial general liability policy, you get what is in essence a form policy. It's been put together over many years of judicial interpretation, regulatory interpretation. The language is pretty standard, and it's roughly the same insurance company to insurance company. When you get a cyber policy, that is, at least when they were first issued, that was not the case at all. They were all very different. They all had different language. There were no judicial interpretations of what that language meant, which means what's covered or not covered is still subject to question and litigation. And some of that's changing. They are getting more form-oriented, but what hasn't occurred is the ongoing body of law about what those terms mean. So that I think is going to have to be shaken out over time as there are more and more cyber policies are written. And the key takeaway, though, is if you get a cyber policy, if you want a cyber policy, you have to really think through what it is you want to protect, and then negotiate, in essence, the policy to protect that, because you're not going to get an off-the-shelf policy that you can say, like you get on your home, that you can say, okay, I understand, you know, if an earthquake happens, I'm not covered. If the roof leaks, I am. You know, okay, I got that. These are not like that. I mean, some cover ransomware, some don't. Some require various preconditions to be satisfied that are hard to satisfy. Some will cover business interruption. Some won't. So it's really a field that you can't just walk into and buy a policy and sleep safely at night. And this is particularly right. An issue for smaller businesses, right? I mean, bigger businesses, you know, the big corporations of the world, they'll have teams of in-house lawyers or outside lawyers that'll pore over it, look at it, and they'll deal with it. It's the smaller businesses that really need to focus on what they're buying and what they're getting. And that's not to say they shouldn't do it, because they offer lots of protections, not the least of which is a team of people that can come in selected by the carrier that can deal with breach, the notice provisions, the regulators, all of that, which is huge for small businesses, because they don't have the financial capacity, the people on staff that have that ability and experience to do that. So there are good reasons to have them, but it's something you have to be careful what you ask for, I guess is the best way of putting it.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, most homeowners policies are concerned with fire and flood and things, but there are some other interesting things that can be covered by a homeowners policy, and I'm wondering if those kinds of policies are shifting in response to this environment as well. I don't know the answer to that. Did you get any inkling of that from the conference?
Yeah, they're shifting, but not in the way that you would like them to. Most carriers, and it's not even it's homeowners policies, commercial general liability policies. Most carriers are making it very clear by adding exclusions and riders to those policies that cyber events of any sort will not be covered. In essence, they want to kind of force you to buy cyber coverage, and with good reason. I mean, they would tell you that, look, when we wrote these commercial general liability policies, these homeowners policies, this was not a risk that we ever contemplated being covered. So your premium and the way we've reserved these policies and estimated our loss is built on an entirely different model. So now we have a different risk and a different model, and we need to price and insure those differently and charge differently for them based upon that different risk. So it's not that they're doing something that is inappropriate necessarily. It's that they're doing something that again, you can't just say, I've got a commercial general liability policy, I must be covered. You probably aren't covered for cyber events, or at least most of them.
Yeah. Hey, Victor in the studio points out to me, I was unaware we have a sponsor at the network here at privacy.com that creates secure virtual cards and completes checkout forms for you, saving you time and money while masking your real card details. So looks like, you know, I'm not the only one who thinks there's a business there model about masking your actual card information and trying to make it more secure. So check out Twit's sponsor, privacy.com, if you think that's interesting.
That was a really good setup, Denise. That was good.
Yeah, no, they're not even sponsoring this episode. That was a gratuitous plug. But thank you, Victor. That's a good point. Where shall we go from here? Let's move on and talk about the social web. So we're going to talk about advertising, which of course impacts all of the same privacy considerations we've just been covering, just in a different context. And before we get to the privacy and also some IP considerations related to advertising, though, this I think is so funny. Payless apparently opened a fake luxury store called Paylessy, sort of capitalizing on this, or maybe we say it Paylessy. I don't know. I think they were trying to mask the fact that they were affiliated with Payless, but they would take their ordinary Payless product, Payless shoe source kind of shoes, etc., and package them differently, market them differently, etc., jump on the whole Instagram influencer trend and see what they could get for these $20 shoes. And they had this great social experiment that they carried out. You could read more about it at Adweek. And it really cracks me up. And what equally cracked me up is that Stanford law professor Mark Lemley, founder of the firm Duri Tangri, tweeted that in one stroke, someone had successfully, Payless had successfully created the tort of reverse counterfeiting. Just love. we have a new advertising artifact tort. What do you think, Stefan?
I actually commented on Professor Lemley's tweet with a single line, which was, make it till you fake it. So, which I think this is what it boils down to. I love this. I absolutely love this. I think brands should do this kind of thing more often. It's kind of edgy and funny. And you know, how often do you see a company sort of exploiting the inherent tension within its own business model with this kind of creativity? I think it's just, it's wonderful.
Yeah, so I think that's a great, go ahead, Steve.
There was a great interview. I just happened to see this on the news last night, and they, I think it was, I can't remember what network it was, but they were interviewing people, and they were, you know, admiring their shoes and saying, "What, look at these shoes, they're really great." And then they would tell them, "Well, they're really Payless shoes," and the look on their faces was just priceless. They were just stricken with their reaction was like, "What?"
Right. All right. Well, I think this is great backdrop to discuss a video that caught my eye in the last week or so by Hasan Minhaj. The Patriot Act is the name of his regular show. And he did a whole segment. It's like a 20-minute long video on the Supreme brand. He's like, most of the time, like you were saying, Stefan, he might not know that much about the GDPR, but he talks about it anyway, is his point. Most of the time, he's sort of faking it till he makes it. But he really actually cares a lot about sneakers and collecting sneakers. So he was happy to do an episode of his show about the Supreme brand and the history of the Supreme brand. And he really goes deep on where the heck this came from and how this sort of skater brand of decks and tennies has become this sought after item and it has this huge aftermarket in sales, you know, much like I'm sure the Paylessy shoes will now have websites that spring up to sell the ones that originally went for $150 for instead $850. So he really does a great job of unpacking the economics of this artificial scarcity. And there were a couple of points in this that I thought were useful to bring out for this show. Number one is how Supreme has become this brand who partners with other brands like Louis Vuitton or Timberland or North Face now has products up on their site, which I'm sure it's got partners clamoring to partner up with it because it's such a hot item. But they really, you know, part of their cachet is not just its iconic Supreme logo, which, of course, it has value in its own right now that it's become this huge sought after brand. But the fact that they will also incorporate, you know, the Louis Vuitton stuff or the North Face stuff or whatever, just the fact that they do these collaborations is really compelling. So the blending of those two IP brands as they release new goods, I think, is really interesting. I'm also sort of interested, and I wasn't able to really figure it out from Wikipedia before the show, is it back in the day when Supreme was just getting started, would they just slap that Louis Vuitton looking pattern on things and say, hey, it's like a Louis Vuitton, but it's Supreme? I don't know if they did that or not, but I think, you know, as of right now, they are nothing but legit in their partnerships and collaborations. The other things I thought were really interesting is, well, for example, if you plug in supreme.com, do it now. We'll wait. Go ahead, plug in supreme.com on your browser. Okay, now come back. You'll notice that Perry Ellis has gone ahead and scooped up that domain and is redirecting it to its own site, which has nothing to do with the Supreme brand. Super interesting. And then finally, from an IP law standpoint, this Hasan Minhaj video quite hilariously released its own parody shirts that do use something like the Supreme logo here. They don't use the Supreme logo, but they use its font. They use that like red background with white lettering. And they did a limited edition of t-shirts that, lo and behold, sold out immediately and are now reselling for 1,500% their original price. And they're really, I think that Hasan Minhaj and his group will have no problem demonstrating that these, if they should have any IP problems over the logo, are fair use, because they are sort of biting commentary on the fact that the Supreme brand, though you might be deceived or misled into thinking that they are some scrappy little skater brand, are actually, they have a huge private equity investor, the Carlyle Group, which is involved in military and defense spending in addition to its investment in the Supreme brand. So any thoughts on all of this, Stefan?
I started noticing those Supreme stickers and logos all over the place a few years ago, and I remember being very confused, and because it didn't, you know, look particularly attractive. And when I found out how much people are paying for it, I was just, wow, this is a marketer's dream. And so obviously, whatever purity existed in the brand at the time quickly gave way to profitability, and that. And there's nothing surprising about that. I'm surprised that anybody's surprised. And why is there an audience for this sort of, you know, revelation? I'm not sure. I mean, this is the world we live in. This is how it works.
Well, the story.
See, pay lessy.
Yeah.
The story kind of that I read about this was that the original Supreme logo was taken from an artist named Barbara Kruger, who's actually a pretty well-known artist. I don't know of her work, but she did a lot of kind of conceptual kind of models and things like that, and she came up with this red box and white, but she never complained about it. And then a few years ago I guess there was a dispute between Supreme and one of the brands that it was slapping stuff on about who owned the logo, and they asked Barbara Kruger about it, and her reaction was something like, don't these people have anything better to do? so the whole thing is kind of the whole thing is kind of bizarre to begin with.
Yeah, well, that she was the subject of one of the shirts that Hasan Minhaj made and sold. I forget exactly the tag they put on it, but you know, Barbara Kruger had it right or something.
I don't know what Barbara Kruger looks like, but I think she's in her 70s, and I just have this picture of this kind of crotchety old lady who tolerates no BS from anybody. It's just like, good grief.
Yeah. Let's see. What does his shirt say about her? Load. It said Barbara Kruger was right. So, yeah. And now, not only is she not benefiting from Supreme's use of the logo, but she's not benefiting from Hasan Minhaj's use of it either.
Well, I think
turtles all the way down.
I think she'd probably like Hasan's use of it better than Supreme's, but I don't know that for a fact.
Yes, probably so. All right. Final advertising related story has to do with inching closer and closer to the science fictional world of the Minority Report. Yael Grauer has a piece at Medium on, social media ads. We've talked a lot about them getting spooky and thirsty and spying on you. But real world ads are definitely not missing out on that. And she has sort of a collection of things like the digital billboard ad for New Balance that aired during Fashion Week in New York that used AI technology to detect and highlight pedestrians who were wearing exceptional outfits. We talked before about the malls in Canada who had issues about using facial recognition potentially to target ads at people in the malls. And she talks more about that kind of thing here. So don't think just because you've dumped your social media channels that you're not going to be advertised to in new, strange, and potentially creepy ways. Just letting you know. What do you think, Stefan? Go ahead, Steve.
I had a speaking of creepy experiences, and I thought about this when I read the article. I spoke mm-hmm. at a cybersecurity conference a couple weeks ago in Dallas, and after it was over, they had a reception, and I was having a couple of drinks with people, and somebody said, "Oh, by the way, have you read this book called American Kingpin?" About the guy that founded Silk Road on the dark web and what has, and it's, I read the book. It is a very good book. So I said, at the time I had not read it. I said, no, I haven't read it. So I went back to the hotel that night and pulled out my Kindle to finish reading a book that I was reading. And lo and behold, when it says books recommended for you, the very first one was American Kingpin. Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe there is something to all this spying on you by the Amazons and the Facebooks of the world.
Right. That book is about Ross Ulbricht and is on my list to read too.
It'll now pop up on your suggested Kindle list tonight.
Right.
So if it does, let me know, would you?
Yeah, no, I will indeed. Just as an aside, I mentioned before we did it as a tip of the week. I think even though it very loosely ties to tech law, it ties more to e-commerce, that this was the first year that Amazon is offering a live Christmas tree option. I ordered one just out of curiosity. And it's so far been a pretty creep-free experience, except here is the lovely little, they partnered with Hallmark to do this, and they send you this whole little sort of fold-out how to care for your tree, but it goes much further than that. Just how to have a nice holiday, brew some hot, sweet, yummy stuff to drink and munch on something Christmassy. So they've got all kinds of little ideas. They've got sugar cookie recipes. So I kind of enjoyed this little insert until I got to the part where they were upselling me yet more holiday foliage from this Amazon Hallmark partnership. And also, of course, although they do it sort of subtly in a parenthetical, sort of almost humorously, that while you're making merry, might we suggest Hallmark Channel's Countdown to Christmas? So they're slipping it in there one way or another. Stefan, any thoughts about any of this?
Yeah, I recently bought a pair of noise canceling headphones, which I don't know why I didn't buy them sooner, because I just love them so much, and I want to now expand on this idea to like have other senses block inputs that I don't want. And one of those would be like blocking, you could imagine like glasses and headphones that just allow you to block out any of this kind of advertising that's being directed to you you know, in this IRL social media updating sort of billboards to kind of target you specifically. You could have this ad blocking technology that responds to that and just sort of lets you move through the world as though there aren't a million people trying to grab your attention and profit from you. So this sort of IRL ad blocking would be a great response to this IRL targeting of advertisements, and you could have this sort of mutually assured destruction where, you know, the robots are facing off and whoever has the best technology will kind of live their life as though it's 1990 and they're just passing anonymously through the streets. And so there's my $1 billion idea.
Call me investor. I mean, it's already happening on the web, right? I mean, the ad blocking versus the ads. So I don't know why it wouldn't move to real life.
Yeah, and you could just sort of, you know, expand with noise canceling headphones. You could cancel out smells. You could cancel out visual stimuli. Anything that you just don't want to see and deal with. And I think that's the future.
Oh, what a good segue to our next story. Let's talk about robots and AI and the Internet of Things. All right, so Tesla, specifically Elon Musk, announced that there were going to be some super fun Easter eggs, software Easter eggs, coming to all Tesla S3 and X cars before the holidays. There's romance mode, toilet humor, and more video games. And listener Jonathan Annette was wondering exactly how those Easter eggs were going to be implemented and whether the car's air filter might be involved to trigger the romance and toilet humor ones. Could you, you know, somehow detect from the air in the car whether someone was becoming amorous, or could you, you could almost certainly detect when a fart joke was in order.
That's complete with smell.
Yes. Complete. So, Steve, you were saying you own a Tesla. Are you looking forward to these software Easter eggs coming your way?
You know, it's funny. My daughter came to visit us over Thanksgiving, and she's early 30s, and she's a very practical person. So she took a ride in my Tesla, and I have the Model 3, and it's got the computer screen right in the middle, and that's your only control. So she got in, I turned it on, and she looked at it, and she said, "There's no way in hell this car can be safe. There's just no way in hell."
Well, on that note, we learned this week that Tesla Autopilot has drivers driving in that mode have driven over 1 billion miles now. So it's somewhat safe, but we learned just this morning, latest in the series of things that go on when cars are in autopilot. Apparently in Palo Alto, which if you were saying you own probably one of the two Teslas in Tennessee, right?
Yeah, let's leave it at Tennessee. That's close enough.
somewhere over there. No, sorry, got the state wrong. Out here in California, they're far more prevalent. And one in Palo Alto apparently had a guy driving along in autopilot who was fast asleep, just snoozing away, has been charged with a DUI. I'm looking at a Mercury News story. I think Victor has one up on the screen as well. And what Victor was telling me, he heard this on the radio on his way to help us with the show this morning, that the CHP officer actually was nudging the car with the police car to try and wake the guy up. So,
he went close to the car and the car slowed down. And I think that nudged the driver. So maybe that was the nudge.
The car slowed down in autopilot mode to avoid being hit. Wow.
If you had it on the cruise control feature, if the police car pulled in front of it, the Tesla would stop. But I'd like to know how you did that, because on mine, when you put it on the auto drive, unless you move the wheel a little bit every 10 seconds or so, it'll turn it off and it'll alarms will go off. And so I've been thinking if there was a way to sort of bypass that feature, then I could take a nap on my way to wherever I was going as well.
Yeah.
So I have to dig in and see how he did that. There must be a way around, workaround.
Oh, goodness. We don't want you sleeping behind the wheel, Steve, please. Not yet. Not until autopilots come a lot further than, say, Alexa now. We were going to talk about Alexa on the witness stand. I don't want to push too much further past our hard out at 1 o'clock Pacific time. But I do think this is interesting. You referred to this article, Steve, about we've talked a lot about people subpoenaing Amazon for data in murder cases, et cetera. That seems to be a trend that is growing. Is there more to this that we should know about or think about?
Yeah, I think there is. Mm-hmm. So here's kind of the thing, and I bumped up against this a few years ago. There was a case in Kentucky, actually. It was a little humorous, but this executive was overseas, and he had his cell phone in his pocket, and he butt-dialed one of his subordinates and who he was thinking about firing, and he had this discussion with another executive about all the things that they can come up with to fire this person. And the person listened to all this on the other end. And so there was a big lawsuit about it, and it went all the way up to the Sixth Circuit. And the Sixth Circuit said, well, the guy that made that butt dialed on the phone, he really had no reasonable expectation that that would be a private conversation. He knew that that was a thing that could happen. He knew there were ways to prevent it, and he didn't take those steps, and so he can't be heard to complain. But the interesting analogy they made was that they said, assume that you are in your bedroom with your drapes wide open. You shouldn't really complain if somebody looks in your bedroom and sees what you're doing, because you've left your drapes wide open. So when you think about that in the context of all the Internet of Things devices that we have, for which we have signed waivers and consent, which gets back to the whole consent issue. You know, can we have a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to those items anymore? And what are the parameters of that when we really, most people sign those waivers without thinking about it? Have we all now opened up our draperies, and will we not be heard to complain about sensitive information that gets to somebody else because we've done nothing to prevent it? And that's kind of, to me, it's kind of a serious issue. You know, what happens with a lot of that information, and what can we do to stop it? Do we want to stop it? I do. Ellie Mistel does. Other people may not. So yeah, there is more to it. It's sort of as a philosophical debate than whether you decide to buy Alexa and what Amazon listen to everything you say, so to speak, or not. It's pervasive throughout our society. And, you know, I could probably go to Ellie's house and find an Internet of Things device that was spewing out data just like Alexa would if he had one. Now he'll probably smack me for saying that next time I see him.
Well, I mean, again, I feel like people's consent around these things is anything but informed, and maybe they don't even know what they're consenting to. And also that it's context, right? I mean, Amazon sells one of these that is supposed to be an alarm clock. It's configured like one, you know, it's made to be kept in your bedroom next to your bed and wake you up in the morning. So, you know, we've talked about that before here on Twill. But it's still an Echo device, and people are going to have to know what they're getting into when they put one of those in their bedroom. What I worry about more, I talked about earlier how when you get one of these reward program cards from your grocery store, there's some literature that you get with it that presumably is telling you something about what they're going to do with the data. But when you get a fridge that has the technology of knowing what's in the fridge and what you've bought and what you may need to reorder, you know, I don't ever recall signing a waiver in connection with my refrigerator. Right. Certainly, I got handed a bunch of stuff, and maybe buried in that stuff, along with the fact that there's no notice that the software doesn't update very frequently, right. is something about, you know, what could be done with your grocery data. And maybe it's going to be sold right. to an insurance carrier. But, you know, I just don't think that people pay attention to that, and they need to, and lawmakers need to.
It's really the Wild West when it comes to the Internet of Things, because there are almost no standards, and I've talked to a lot about this before. I mean, the developers have gone out and created all these devices, and there's very few protections, as you said. There's no patching, there's no upgrades. You don't know how long they're going to last. You don't know what the malfunction rates are going to be. You don't know what's going to happen when they malfunction. And so there's a whole body of law waiting to be developed about the Internet of Things and responsibilities and liabilities. And I broke in on Stefan. I apologize.
No, not at all. I just wanted, Stefan, I wanted to see if you wanted to chime in on any of this before we close out the show.
Just my recurring point that it always amazes me, because that the focus is always on the state's ability to sort of use this information against you. And that's the focus in Ellie's piece, and completely legitimate concern. I share it and I understand it. But I'm always amazed that the focus tends to be on the state and not on sort of company to company behavior, and which maybe implicates different constitutional questions. But it still has the potential to really impact your life in a negative way. And I think it's sort of interesting to me that there's this built-in resistance that a lot of people have to the government knowing things about you, and they kind of put their alerts up when that's the issue. But there's a lot more trust when it comes to private companies, and I continue to be baffled by why that is, why that distinction means so much to people.
Yeah. That's a good point. And on that note, we'll make Fiendish Fridge our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, and move right along to, let's do our tip of the week first. And we've got a couple of tips of the week. So number one, I just wanted to mention we're on episode 444 of This Week in Law, and I knew that was going to be some sort of client error on the web, HTTP status error. And sure enough, it is the connection closed without response error. So just so you know that for your future journeys around the web, when you hit 444, you may either be hitting the episode that we're recording just now, or you may be hitting a non-standard status code used to instruct Nginx to close the connection without sending a response to the client. So thought our audience might need to know that. Our other tip of the week is, if you're in China and fairly well known, make sure you stay the heck off the side of the bus. Now, when I think of a billboard on the side of the bus, I always think of Carrie Bradshaw from Sex and the City and her iconic, you know, moment from the opening montage where she gets splashed by the bus on which her picture appears as a billboard. Well, she's not the only one to have been done in by a bus where her picture was a billboard. Apparently in China, in one of the regions where facial recognition is being used for crime fighting purposes, the CEO of a company there was featured on the side of a bus, and the AI decided that she was jaywalking. And let's see, the facial recognition system in the city of Ningbo caught Dong Mingzhu, the chair of appliance making giant Gree Electric, running a red light. Only it turned out not to be Dong, but rather an advertisement featuring her face on the side of the bus. So The police there have said they've upgraded their tech to avoid issues like this in the future. I'm just not sure which future they're talking about and when their updates are going to be meaningful. But in any event, our tip of the week is keep yourself off the bus sides in China. Stefan?
I'm reminded of the Chihuahua versus the cookie discrepancy that surfaced all over the internet with AI. Only this time it was a person and a billboard.
Yes, person and a billboard. Let's see. Our resource of the week, actually a couple of resources. Again, we're like in the thick of the holiday shopping frenzy. And I just wanted to mention that I think a great thing to do for your friends and family for the holidays is to support good organizations, good journalism that you enjoy. We actually have a tip jar for the Twit Network. If you'd like to support our work here, that's at twit.tv/about/tip-jar. So that's one thing you could do. I have noticed that Ars Technica now has a pro level that will eliminate tracking and ads and all that good stuff. Something like $3 a month will get you that. That would be a nice gift for somebody. I was thinking of buying a subscription to the New York Times for several people. So just, you know, sort of a non-standard gift that could keep on giving. The EFF, of course, always a good organization to support. So keep those kinds of things in mind as the holidays roll around. And also, if you ever need to know everything there is to know about emoji law, Professor Eric Goldman has you covered. There is a November 29th blog post up at his Technology and Marketing Law blog that includes all of his various scholarship on the issue, various slides from presentations that he's done, and fun photos as well. So if you need to know what's up in the realm of emoji law, he's got it all compiled for you right there in one place. And we wouldn't, of course, have a show for you without our animal selfie of the week. We have, of course, featured various videos where birds have stolen GoPros. We've featured other ones where they have been intentionally placed on a raptor and sent into flight. This is in the latter category. This is GoPro plugging the fact that they claim to have eliminated shaky video in the Hero 7. This is an eagle soaring over a soccer field. And lo and behold, it is pretty smooth. And we've got nice views of the eagle, too, making it a definite animal selfie. But I would say in this instance that PETA might not have much of a case. They might have something to talk about whether eagles should be used to promo new technology. But other than that, I don't know if the eagle would have any rights to this one, since I think it's just taking a nice afternoon flight and happened to have captured it on film. Any thoughts on eagles and smooth video, Stefan?
You know, birds are pretty cool, and seeing the world from their perspective is always fun. But, you know, beyond that, it's just a bird with a camera on it.
I found this at a photography blog that seems to agree with GoPro that the upgrades here, because apparently they flew another eagle around with a different camera, and the stabilization on this one is better. I also like his comment that it's amusing to read the YouTube comments to these sorts of videos. This one apparently had someone chime in and say, "What application needs to be installed on the smartphone to control this drone? Angry Birds?" So. Anyway, on that note, I believe we will bring this one in for a landing. And it's just been so great to chat with you both today. Steve Emery, so nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Enjoyed it.
And Stefan Schweide, great to have you back with me here at This Week in Law.
Great to be back.
Steve Embry, do you have anything you want to plug or let people know about before we sign off for the day?
Tech Oil Crossroads is my blog. Feel free to come and look at it. Maybe you'll find something interesting there. I have a lot of fun doing it, so I hope people will read it.
I know that they will. Thank you so much for contributing to the blogosphere with your great stuff. And you too, Stefan. I love the stuff I already mentioned that you guys do on your firm blog. So great job with that. Please keep it up.
Thank you.
Anything else going on in Seattle that we should know about? Or should we get the heck on out of here?
Well, there's always plenty happening in Seattle. It's a vibrant city despite all the rain. But I think law and tech related specifically that hasn't been already covered, I think we can sign off.
All right. Then that's what we will do. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for getting together with me here today. It's been really, really fun. Thank you all for joining us as well. If you head on over to twit.tv/twill, that's our show page, you will find out various ways, means, and manners that you can enjoy the show at your own leisure there. Or if you prefer to join us live, we record every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC, I think, since the time change. Or is it 1800? I always forget. I think it's 1800 UTC this time of year. Anyway, we'll iron that out and get it right for you next time. But if you're in the EU, the UK, wherever, you can figure out and join us live as well. Because we love having a live audience for the show. We have live chat. UTC time is listed at twit.tv/twill, tells me Patrick Delahenty in our chat. That's at irc.twit.tv. You can jump in there and join us during the show. It's 1900 time this time of year. 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC is when we do the show each Friday. So please do join us whenever, however you can. We're so thrilled that you do. Please keep sending me great tips as you journey around the web and see things that we should be paying attention to, talking about, thinking about here at This Week in Law. Send us guests that you think we should invite on. We're constantly hearing from people with wonderful suggestions for the show. So thank you so much. That is my holiday gift from you all. Keep it coming. Love it, love it, love it. And we will see you next week in December on This Week in Law. Until then, take care.